another 60, actually tomorrow morning, from Cape Kennedy. Actually, launch complex 40. He has two launch complexes down there, down at Bar 39A and 40. And with that, he's going to have a total of 120 satellites up there. And then by the end of the year, he's going to launch at least, he's hoping to launch at least three more launches in the next couple of months each one 60 satellites. Now he needs to put this into operation. He needs around 1,200. He's guessing around 20 launches or so. So sometime maybe by the end of next year, he's going to be signing people up to connect to the internet via the satellite. You know, and these satellites are going to be around 300 to 400 miles up, so you won't have the latency period, you know, that you might have for geosynchronous. And if that all goes well, he plans on launching, you know, these satellites year after year. And he plans on someday having 12,000 satellites up there. And then he put a request in for more, so he could add another 30,000 to that. So, and they'll eventually be in different inclinations. This first grouping will be in around 52 degrees inclination. So he's going to be able to carry, or pick up the center part of the Earth, you know, near the equator, going up to, you know, up to 50 degrees north and 50 degrees south. So that should be interesting. As far as the rocket goes that he's using, it's going to be another Falcon 9 rocket. He's using the latest version of the Falcon 9 booster, which are all reusable. And this will be the first time he launches a booster that he's recovered three times, so it'll be the fourth launch for this particular booster. And that drives the price way down. He's got these prices down to $62 million launch a few years ago, and I'm sure that's starting to come down as time goes on. Compare that to some of the other launches, like the Atlas V that NASA always launches, is probably, you know, twice or even three times that number. So another thing that's going to be reusable on this particular flight is the fairings. You know, the fairings are these big, over 40 foot long composite diameter. This will be the first time they'll be reused. He captured them from a previous launch back in April. And he actually got them out of the water, and he's able to dry them out good, and he's going to launch them, and he's going to try to recover them again. Each one, the fairings that cover up the satellites are $6 million a piece, so instead of throwing them away, which we've done since the beginning of the space program, he's been recapturing these, you know, a few here and a few there.
Is this a radio broadcast?
Call out, please. Nothing heard. So that will be launched tomorrow, which we you'll be able to watch, not on NASA, because it's not a NASA launch at all. You'll be able to see that on the SpaceX webcast. So you put that into the computer, and you'll be able to see that launch. Okay, another past launch last week was last Monday was the Starliner launch. Starliner for the first time in on White Sands, New Mexico. Yeah, emergency abort system. What are you using? The idea of it is to save a crew if the crew was on board. Successfully. We have four of these. Give you an idea of on a Redstone rocket, he went up around 70,000 pounds of thrust. That was the first launch. Safely getting. Had 66. Stated.
You're not allowed to broadcast on ham radio.
Heat shield is coming down first. And, without the service module separated, that's the one with all the engines in it. And eventually, parachutes came out. Yeah, that was the only glitch. It's supposed to be three big parachutes that came out. Two big parachutes came out. And so, that was working. A safe landing for a crew of four. Find that the reason for it was there was a pin, there's a pin that connects the drogue chute. The drogue chute pulls out the main parachute. Connected. Test for 17. Uncrewed five rocket up to the International Space Station. Stay docked there for a couple of weeks. Sands, New Mexico area on land. That all works out. Stay there. Turning back to Earth. That would be the first.
When you override that guy that's putting a carrier on you.
Say again. Call letter and who's that?
Somebody may not realize that the technical net on Sunday night has the question and answer session, the science talk session, and then the space report session. We're now listening to the space report section of the technical net, and Paul WS2N is telling us the latest of what's going on with NASA. And periodically he leaves some space for people to ask a question if they have any questions about what he's talking about. This is not broadcast. He's giving us information about technical net, about the space report. This net has existed for 35 years. Somebody just tuned in newly and doesn't quite understand what's going on. WS2N with the space report, K2I, there you go ahead, Paul.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I'm more than willing to listen to anybody with questions. I'd rather much do that than give a list of things that happened during the week. They're interesting, but what's more interesting is if people ask questions about it, then we could answer that more in detail. The most of AC2GS does. So, any comments or questions? And we covered the space industry from the past to the present and to the future. The future is a problem because half the time we predict things that don't come true. When I say we, I mean the news media. So, you know, the science is there, but sometimes the money isn't. For what they plan on doing, for instance, putting people on the moon by 2024, might not happen. My guess, if you listen to Fastnet's, I'm guessing that going back to their original number from a couple of years ago, which would be 2028, when they get to the moon. So, that was the story on the Boeing Starliner. And hopefully Boeing gets their act together with that 110. And, they go through these problems. They've had nothing but parachute problems. And I would have thought they would have had that. I didn't think that would be the problem. Other things might be a problem, parachutes ripping, things not going right. But not to have that pin set. Now, they're going to make sure on the next flight. Well, they've already made sure on the next flight that won't be a problem. So, SpaceX is competing with them, and they've had similar problems with their parachutes. Boeing has three big parachutes that are coming out, and the Dragon crew vehicle has four parachutes that are coming out. Dragon is going to be much heavier coming down than the Starliner from Boeing. Let me drop it. And the reason for it is they both have service modules attached to the crew vehicle, and they both carry four people to the space station. But the reason SpaceX is much heavier on board, they're carrying the fuel for their abort system on board the capsule itself, not on the service module. So the engines and everything is set up in the crew vehicle, where Boeing takes a different approach and has the engines. You can see the four engines attached to the service module. So they need three parachutes to come down. SpaceX is going to be much heavier, and they're going to need four. So which one will be the first one to make it to the space station? We don't know yet, but they're competing, and my guess will probably be within definitely the first part of next year. We should see a crew launch to the space station. Right now, we send people up on the Soyuz, Americans on Soyuz with the Russians. They launched from Kazakhstan. And probably about 10 years ago, it used to be about $20 million a seat. The Russians keep raising the price. Now it's $80 million per seat for every NASA astronaut to go up. See that? I let the CW ID go by. NASA does not want to take out any more seats for $80 million a pop. Well, they would sign up for it, but Congress is the ones that hold the purse strings, and I don't think they're going to get that extension. So next year, what they plan on doing is, they don't have any more, they got the contract out like 2 years before, and they haven't done that with Russia. So they plan on cutting back on the amount of people they have on the space station. Right now we have a total of six people on board the space station. We have two American guys, two American women, one fellow from Italy, and two Russians. So, you've got a total of six people. So now that's going to drop down to three next year, with one American and two Russians. So you're going to have a lot less science coming back to the space station. You need three people, not full time, but he needs most of that time is occupied with just maintaining the station and themselves, with the cargo deliveries coming up on a regular basis. You might have a situation where going to get very little science back from the space station. These cargo vehicles, new crew vehicles get their act together, that might only last 6 months or so. But you got this one astronaut, Chris Cassidy, who's been up there twice, is not now going to be going up there a third time, and you might have, just have three people going around, which is going to cut back on probably a lot of NASA contacts with, ham contacts. The ARIS amateur radio on the International Space Station might be, not cut off entirely, but it could slow down significantly. They do quite a bit of contact every year. And the Russians do it on their side as well. So it's a shame, but I could see this happening. Unless they get Boeing Starliner and Dragon work. Before I go on, is there any questions or comments? This is WS2M. Okay, last week they made an announcement that Voyager 2 actually passed into interstellar space actually a year ago, but it wasn't until just now that they confirmed that has happened. Voyager 1 quite a few years ago has already done that, and now Voyager 2 is officially going on the outside of the solar system as far as the heliosphere is concerned. The influence of the sun's effect on the plasma within the solar system itself. It's at a certain level inside the solar system, and there aren't any cameras or anything left on Voyager that are operating, but they do have these plasma detectors, and they can tell the temperature of the plasma, and they can tell the direction of the plasma, which way it's moving. And when things all of a sudden change, after, over 40 years in space, they launched in 1977, and plasma detectors all of a sudden tell you that, the plasma is coming in a different direction, and it's actually hotter than the what it's been receiving. They know that it's now entered into a different part of the solar system, and they said that because of the two spacecraft, they're able to confirm something that they've theorized. The heliosphere apparently is expanding and contracting in relationship to the 11-year cycle. And we think of the 11-year cycle for sunspots and for ham radio contacts. And scientists are now looking at that same 11-year cycle for determining, how much the heliosphere is expanding or contracting. Because Voyager 1 and 2 left the solar system in different locations, they can now confirm that is the way the heliosphere is, and which, should be good. So NASA's, by the way, looking into another launch. They would like to use the SLS system, Space Launch System. And they're thinking about creating another interstellar probe and just using an SLS to get it out there as fast as possible, instead of waiting, decades, on end to do that. And they plan on launching a probe with the Space Launch System, small probe, launched by that thing. My guess would probably get out there in, maybe 20 years instead of 40 years. So they're thinking about it. It's not funded. It's not even drawn up yet, but it's on the drawing board. Any comments, questions? Okay, and talking about the Sun, European Space Agency has a spacecraft that's just been delivered to Florida. That's called the Solar Orbiter. Solar Orbiter is just what it says. It's going to orbit the Sun. Not the Earth, but the Sun. It's going to launch and use the Venus and Mercury as gravitational assist to help the solar orbiter get to its proper orbit. Most of our satellites are involved with solar observing. Back in the 70s, you had the Helios missions, and nowadays you have the Stereo 1 and Stereo 2 that's in orbit roughly the same distance from the Sun that we are. But going around the Sun, I think one right now is on the opposite side of the Sun. And then you have other missions, such as the Parker mission that NASA launched a couple of year or two ago, that's now on the way to the closest approach of the Sun. But all of them are along the ecliptic plane, the same inclination as the orbits of the planets. Solar orbiter is not going to do that. It's going to go on a highly ecliptic orbit, and that's why they need to use the not only the gravity assist, to change the velocity of solar orbiter, but also to use those planets to change the inclination of its flight. Near future, anyway, I think 2022, by the time it gets orbit, photographs the poles of the Sun. We've never had that done. We've had instruments look at the Sun through Ulysses on the looking down at the poles, but never any actual photographs of the Sun. And scientists are looking to look at that, and they think there's a lot of unanswered questions, and that will help them fill in the gaps. But, solar orbiter, built by the European Space Agency, launched on an Atlas V rocket, probably around February 6th, right around the same time they plan on launching the crew vehicle of the Starliner, if everything goes right. So they're going to be competing for that window, February 6th. So that should be an interesting flight. They're going to fly in a 4-1-1 configuration. That means the fairing will be 4 meters in diameter. It'll have only one solid booster rocket attached to it, and also one second stage rocket instead of two. NASA, the European Space Agency. The European Space Agency, like $1.5 billion to build this thing. But because NASA is launching it for them, they're putting up the cost of the launch. That will be NASA's contribution to the mission, and they'll get shared science for that as well. This is WS2N. Questions, comments? And let's see, now the TESA vehicle, the TESA spacecraft, has launched about a year or so ago. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. This is the one that's very similar to Kepler. Kepler is responsible for discovering thousands of planets using the transits of planets in front of their star. And TESA is doing the same thing, but not for the stars that are, you know, 15,000 light years away, like Kepler was doing, but this is only looking at a couple hundred light years away, so, you know, local stars. And already it's found 29 planets, and some of them are Earth-sized, and some of them are in the Goldilocks zone, which means not too hot, not too cold, possible water within those planets. And because of that, those discoveries, once James Webb Space Telescope goes up there, that could look at those planets, and Tesla's giving it the heads up of, you know, where to point. James Webb will have all kinds of spectrometers on there. They'll be able to tell what the atmosphere is made of, whether or not it's possible to have life on some of these planets. You know, like for instance, if it has methane, they'll be able to know that's a possibility. So TESS is doing good. It surveyed the whole southern sky, you know. The whole first year is spent doing that. It's got these four CCD cameras attached to it, all staring at the southern sky and looking for transits. And since it's completed that, now it's going to start looking at the northern sky for the next year. It takes about a year to cover the survey of a whole hemisphere. We'll look forward to seeing how TESS is doing. TESS was launched by SpaceX Falcon 9 a year ago and put into a very highly elliptical orbit. And I mean really highly elliptical. You know, it'll come as close as, something like 30 or 40,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. But then it will go all the way out to the equivalent of where the moon is. Quarter of a million miles out, 250,000 miles, and then come back again. So during that, those trips out to the distance of the moon and all the way back, it's scanning the sky, doing all its work, and not transmitting back to Earth. But then it gets close to Earth, say 60,000 miles away, starts transmitting away, and transmits tons of data. And they're talking about terabytes of that data that have already been returned from tests. They figured it out. It would be equivalent to receiving 6,000 DVDs. You know, that's how much data is being transmitted back. So, and then, you know, it shuts off and starts heading back toward the moon. Moon's orbit, and it starts all over again, month after month. So, that's the deal with that. Let me drop it for any comments or questions. Not to be outdone, SpaceX has a competitor called OneWeb. OneWeb is another company that's been contracting with Soyuz rockets to launch eventually thousands of satellites as well. Not as many as SpaceX, but they're up there. And they plan on launching their first 30 operational satellites within, January will be the first time they launch. But they've had some money problems and legal problems, and apparently I guess they're getting it worked out for them to go ahead with the launch with the Soyuz rocket from South America, from French Guiana. So they'll be doing that. Then they have other contracts with Soyuz rockets from Kazakhstan, launched by the Russians. So we'll see how that works out. I think SpaceX is already, they are already way ahead, so I think they got a good shot at actually setting up this infrastructure to have a broadband connection. I think it would be really strange to, be paying the service provider, a monthly fee instead of, ones that we pay now that are essentially, running cables from one end of the globe to the other. and this guy's going to put up 1,000, then I'm talking about eventually, you know, 12,000 to maybe even 30 or 40,000 satellites. It's pretty incredible considering you have about 8,000 satellites that are active right now. And, you know, they're going to double that and triple that real quick. So it's an amazing, it's amazing that they got approvals to do this with Intelsat approving some of these launches as well. Intelsat approves launches for a lot of these missions. You know, they coordinate all these different countries where the satellites are going to be, how long they're going to be there, and so on and so forth. Are they going to be able to deorbit themselves? Stalling by SpaceX. Have these small thrusters on board, ion thrusters, and they'll be able to deorbit themselves and they want, and they're using those small thrusters for moving around in space. And they're not using xenon gas; they're using krypton gas, which is a lot less expensive. Xenon gas is, you know, it's a heavier gas, so, you know, it works better, but the price of xenon compared to krypton is like 100 to 1 or something. So with thousands of satellites, it pays for SpaceX to use krypton instead of xenon. But I mean, they're working. He's got 60 of them up there now. He's adding another 60, and by the end of this year, he'll probably add at least another 120. And then by next year, he plans on launching 24 flights, you know, roughly, you know, once every 2 weeks. You know, putting 60 satellites up in a shot. So, any questions, comments? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Okay, that's about it. I went through that list. I thought pretty quick. And if anybody has questions, comments, I'll be here for that. If not, we're going to turn back over to Dick. Any questions or comments?
Are you saying you intend to quit early tonight? You run out of material, Paul? And we haven't mentioned the fact that Mercury will be crossing in front of the sun tomorrow, starting at 7:30 in the morning up until 1 in the afternoon. That's the good news, but you can't see it without a good telescope. Mercury is only 10 seconds of arc in angular diameter when viewed from the Earth, which means you could fit 180 individual Mercuries across the width of the sun. That gives you an idea of how small that dot is. And we won't have another crossing of Mercury in front of the sun until, I think it's 2032. So for those who are deep into astronomy and using their telescope, it might be fun to look at that tomorrow between 7:30 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon, if the sky is not completely clouded over. Maybe you already mentioned that earlier, but I thought I'd mention it. Back to you for any comment on this poll. WS2N, K2RIW.
I've read about it, but, you know, it's not one of these things that you go out and look at the sun, you know. You definitely need a telescope. You know, you can't go there with a welding lens and look at the sun and see anything. You need a solar lens attached to your telescope, because, you know, without the telescope, you're not going to see anything. So I kind of let that one slide. Although some of us might have that capability, you know, some kind of a telescope. I think they said 50, it would have to be 50 times, you know, per strength. You know, you don't need a super duper telescope. You know, you just, you know, something that would be able to do that with a strong solar lens. You know, you can't grab a telescope and just look at it. You know, you burn your eyes out. You know, so you really have to know what you're doing. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, the only kind of solar filter you should use with binoculars or telescope is the one that goes up front. Various magazines will sell you let's say there's a German-made film that you can put in front of a telescope. You can buy various kinds of solar filters that you put in front of a telescope. Don't put it at the eyepiece. I did that once. And all that light you're collecting at the front of the telescope gets focused down to that filter at the eyepiece, which runs very hot. And the filter that I put at the eyepiece cracked. And so that's not safe. So a 50 power will allow you to resolve Mercury. In other words, really see its shape. With a smaller gain of the telescope, you will tell that there's a black dot drifting across the sun. And it's not going to go directly across the middle of the sun, by the way. I think it's the lower one-third is where it goes across from our point of view. But it's amazing how infrequent Mercury and Venus going across the sun is, how infrequent those occulting events are, because each of our orbits are tilted, and the tilt of the orbits don't match. They only cross each other at certain times. It's sort of like you and the other automobile are going in other directions or at right angle streets have intersecting paths where you could have accidents. But luckily, we don't arrive at the same point at the same time, even though we've got crossing paths. And it's sort of what's happening with Mercury, Venus, and Earth. They only cross at very specific times. Okay. Anyone have any further questions or comments on Mercury's crossing in front of the sun tomorrow? Give me a call. That is K2RIW.
About as close as I'm going to get with it, you know, with that is Dick is looking at my, they call it the SkyMap app. You know, I have that on my phone. If you have an Android phone, you can download SkyMap. And as long as you have a GPS and a compass type of thing on your, incorporated into your phone, which a lot of the new phones have, it works really, really good. You hold it up in the air and you point it around the air and until eventually you see the planet on the phone itself. You know, so you'll be able to point the phone to the sun and you'll see Mercury. It's the exact same location as the sun. It'll show the sun, a big sun. It'll show up Mercury. That's about as close as I'll get. Back to you there.
There must be a NASA or some other website, Sky and Telescope website, to allow us to watch it with a real good solar telescope. Have you heard any reports along those lines, Paul?
Yes.
Go ahead, Roy.
That's a good idea. I'm sure we can put that in. Roy, go ahead.
You go to roy.ac2gs. There is a link for that. Tomorrow, NASA will be publishing images and videos of the transit of Mercury.
Sounds good. That's an all-inclusive list of yours, Roy. Well done. Okay, I guess we're going to put ribbons on it tonight. 73 you all. Bye-bye for now. Back to Roy if he wants to repeat his addresses. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Certainly. Thank you, Dick. I'll always take the opportunity. Again, if you have any mailbag questions, any technical questions for Dick, and you can't get access to our repeater, or if you have any space-related questions or comments for Paul, or if you have anything for me, if you have any topics you'd like me to cover, as I covered potable water sources tonight, or any other subjects that interest you of a scientific nature, or if you have a puzzler you'd like to share with me, or if you don't agree with things that I've said, feel free to offer references. The email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for all the stories that I make and for that transit of Mercury across the sun, you can go to my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. Once again, want to thank Paul, want to thank Dick for the opportunity, want to thank everyone who participated tonight I enjoyed the experience. I hope everyone out there did as well. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I will be clear. Until next week, guys. We'll see you again.
Bye-bye, Roy. Bye-bye, Paul. Take your eyes up, you're clear.
Okay, 73. We'll be back next week. And Roy, your resistor code, very good. I like that story. Makes you think about the other colors that are involved as well. Thought about that stuff in a while. 73. Tomorrow we have the club info net, and that would be on its repeater at 8:30. And that's it, 73. Go Limac. Go Tech. Go.
GXM, you still listening? Mitch, WA2CDL.
WA2CDL from WB2GXM, go ahead.
Oh, how you doing? I just figured I'd see if you were still listening. Yeah, we really haven't had a chance to speak much. I know I hear you a lot on the TechNet. And I just wanted to say I admire your knowledge of what you talk about on the TechNet. It's pretty good.
Well, I don't talk about too much. I contribute when I can. Thank you, though.
I guess you must be in a technical field as far as a job.
No, I work for a printer, but I like to know stuff, so I read up a lot on things. It's got me this far in ham radio, so I don't slack off on that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. When were you licensed? What year?
Novice in 1970. Quickly to advanced by the middle of the decade. Then I kind of stayed there till recently when I went for extra.
Oh, yeah, okay, you're like me. I got licensed in the late 60s. And was never a novice, though. I went into the city. You probably went into the city, too. I guess maybe in the 70s. I went into Barrack Street with a friend of mine. He had his novice, and I had nothing. And remember the old 610 forms? I had it filled out general. And when I went to, when I handed in my paper, I forgot the guy's name all of a sudden. It'll come back to me. And he said to me, "Where's your novice?" And I said, "I don't have one." He said, "You have general course, Bob." I said, "Yeah, I want to go right to the general." So he says, you good with the code? And I said, yeah, I think I can pass the 13 words. 13 words of it, which I did. I took the test and I got my general. And I stayed a general until the late 90s when I finally took the extra. It was after the code, after they expired, the 20 word a minute code. By the way, the repeater's going to shut down. If you want, I can go and talk to you on UHF. That'll stay up.
Dang, I can't do it because I'm using an HT. I'm about a mile from North Shore, so I can hit that with the HT fine. But after the repeater goes away, no such luck. But I don't remember where I took the test. Absolutely do not remember it at all. So, unfortunately. But I did get on the air for a bunch of time with a vertical with a coil on it. I can't remember the manufacturer. And I was working CW up and down the East Coast. Actually played chess with a guy in Maryland for a while. And that was fun, except we made the mistake of not repeating moves to each other. So he'd make a move, and I'd say, "What are you talking about?" Because I miscopied 10 moves back, And he did check bait, and I didn't even know. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm going to probably disappear at 12:04.
Yeah, you are. Because the repeater will go off. Where are you located that you're close to the repeater?
Jericho Turnpike, Floral Park.
Oh, you're right there. Okay. I know the area. I used to live in Deepdale Gardens. You know where that is?
No, I don't. WB2GXM.
You know where Little Neck Parkway is? Do you know where Little Neck Parkway is located?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Yeah, just north of the Northern State or Grand Central. On Little Neck Parkway is Deepdale Gardens. Basically, right across the street from Glen Oaks Gardens. If you know where Glen Oaks Gardens is.
Yeah, you could have spit at the repeater. You would have hit it. So where are you living now?
West Hempstead. Yeah, I moved here in the year 2000. Coming up on 20 years. So I lived in those apartments, guard apartments, from the late 80s to the year 2000. And then I moved here. I'm originally from Merrick. That's where I grew up, if you know where that is. I moved to Merrick in 1962.
Yeah, I have friends down there. It's a nice town. Had a bunch of bars we used to hang out in. So, it's very cool. It's always nice.
Okay. Yeah, I figured you would if you like this kind of stuff. Are you interested? Have you ever been to the HRU, Ham Radio University?
No, I have not, but I am thinking of going this January. Looks like a lot of fun, you know. I work nights, and sometimes, well, most of the time, it's hard for me to get up before 10 o'clock in the morning, so I miss a lot.
All right. I wish there was another repeater you could go to. Do you know another one that you can that you have programmed in that we can go to and keep talking?
Well, I doubt I'm going to hit anything with 4 watts.
147.09 you'll hit.
Where is that?
It's not far from you. The only thing is, I don't know if it's up. I have to check it to see if it's up. It may not be. But, I'm inviting you, HRU, I'll be there with Roy, AC2GS. We're going to be giving a presentation on test equipment for HRU. So if you want to, you know, come down, you'll see us. We'll be, we're going to be doing, I think it's the last session, I believe.
Okay, well, this is the last transmission because it's 12:03. I'm looking forward to meeting Roy. I was supposed to see him at the last Ham Fest, and I crapped out on that too because I was sleeping late, and I was sick too. Anyway, okay, WA2CDO from WB2GXM. Have a great night, sir.
All right. By the way, the call is CDL. L is in love. Commercial driver's license is the is the call. All right, I'll talk to you more about it. Maybe you'd be interested in transmitter hunting, direction finding, because I'm big into that. We go on hunts all the time. I can tell you more about it next time if you want.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2.
Yeah, you can still hear me.
Repeater.
All right. You're not going to come. We'll talk next time, Dwayne. It's WHCDO.
at tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
KD2SBO mobile listening.
W2VL repeater.
This is K2KND.
KD2KND, KD2SBO, good morning.
Good morning. Name is Richie. I'm not getting the call sign. Is it, excuse me, STO, Sam, Tom, Oscar?
Yeah, good morning, Richie. It is Kilo Delta 2, Sierra, Bravo, Oscar. The name is Joe.
All right, very good, Joe. SBO. Also sounds like a pretty new call sign. Welcome to amateur radio.
Yeah, roger that, Richie. Down here in the canyons of Manhattan, actually right in front of Mount Sinai Hospital on Fifth Avenue at this point in time.
I think we spoke the other day. You deal with medical appliances and you have to look for parking spots when you get there early, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That is correct. Well, good to talk to you again.
Well, that's what happens. That is the beauty of a local repeater. You get to know everybody. And, you know, when you're on it off, suddenly people remember the call sign, they remember the name, they won't have to ask each day what it is. But now, do you work any other place other than Mount Sinai, or you get assigned there for a period of time while you're working with specific devices?
Nope, I'm assigned actually to the five boroughs. Mount Sinai is a major account for my company, but we're all over in just about every hospital and radiology center in the five boroughs here in the city.
Okay. You know, you're dealing in a hobby where there's a lot of trained technicians and things. We've had some of our guys work for GE and whatever bought it out, GE. They were doing the electron microscopes and other test equipment. So that's one of the things you'll find some people here very familiar with whatever it is that you do. You can be almost anything in this lifetime, and there's somebody on the repeater that has been there, done that, and perhaps still doing it.
Yeah, that's great. I found others in similar fields to mine. It's good. I really enjoy that aspect of the hobby. I do, however, notice that this repeater isn't very active in the morning. Maybe I'm just not, you know, listening enough. I generally listen when I'm down here in the city. But it doesn't seem like it livens up until the evening.
Well, there's a lot of guys that commute. I think it might be a little early for some of the commuters, but a group of guys went over to DMR for a variety of reasons. But, you know, Limark has, I keep losing the count here, we have 2 meters, 440, 220, 1.2 DMR, Fusion, maybe something else in the mix. So we actually have 7 or 8 repeaters. And people will use different things, like a group will go on 440 on their way to work. So it's the diversification that keeps any particular repeater from being totally active. But usually on this repeater, when you come on, there's somebody who's listening and eventually will come back to you.
Yeah, that's great. Definitely seems to be the repeater that is most active. I've tried several other Manhattan repeters, including an Sinai repeater, and nobody ever really comes back to you.
Yeah, I was explaining to someone else last night also, we are a mobile amateur radio club. We have a meeting once a month, but it's still a mobile amateur radio club, and so it was designed to keep people in contact pretty much from maybe the Hamptons. The Hamptons is a little bit of a stretch, and we're working on it, but the Hamptons right into New Jersey, just across the Hudson. So it's a big coverage. There's a lot of people that's listening, and Limark itself, on average, has between 350 and 400 members. So not all of them or a large percentage of them use the repeaters. They support the club, but there's 100, 150 people who do use the repeaters, and that's why there's bound to be somebody to come back to you at some point.
No big deal. I do appreciate you coming back to me, though. I've entered the parking garage, so I'm not sure if you're going to be able to copy me much longer.
Now you're getting noisy. In fact, I missed what you said. I think you said, did you say what? That wasn't even English. What did you say? You entered the parking garage?
Yeah, roger that. I am now in the parking garage, my friend. If you can't hear me, hopefully you'll get the 73s KD2SBO on the side.
Yep, I got that. Is that the parking garage that goes all the way up to the roof and it's open on top? Okay, I'll take that as a sign. Anyway, 73 K2KND.